Kalmika is Māori of the Tuhurangi iwi, and he's about to take up a position as professor at the University of Canterbury, School of Māori and Indigenous Studies in New Zealand. Previously, he worked as a criminal and Treaty of Waitangi lawyer, librarian, and research contracts manager. He now works almost entirely in the area of Māori thought and philosophy, with a particular focus on its revitalisation within a colonised reality. He's committed to investigating Indigenous notions of holism and is currently working on the Māori concepts of nothingness and darkness in response to an Enlightenment focus on clarity, and it's speculating, and he's speculating on how they can form the backdrop of academic expression. He's interested in current debates on crossovers between Māori thought and philosophy, education and science. I'd like to welcome now Kalmika and look forward to hearing your talk, Kal. Thank you.
Kia ora tātou, and thank you very much, Sonia, for that very generous welcome and introduction. I realise that time is short, so I'll get straight into my presentation, which is, I'm just getting over a bit of a cold, which is called The Problem of Embodiment for the Māori Academic. Quite a few years ago, I came across something that the Sioux writer and philosopher Vine Deloria Jr. wrote, which has stuck with me over the years and indeed has spurred me on in my own research interests. He said, and here I paraphrase him, that Indigenous students were torn between representing things in the world in traditional ways on the one hand and representing them according to a very different set of conventions in academia on the other. By this, I took him to mean that there were some fundamentally different principles of work which led to an imbalance in the student. His thinking, as I say, would stay with me and would bring me to think about how this, what might be called imbalance, would take place for Māori students and scholars, including, of course, myself. I was left with a highly speculative landscape to work with, which, of course, has profound benefits. It seemed to me Vine Deloria Jr. was not simply writing about a racial issue from a political perspective. As a philosopher, he identified the need to write on the largely hidden, unprovable even, influence of a foreign style of thinking on Indigenous students. Anishinaabe writer and philosopher Arola started to help me flesh things out, and in a style which will be somewhat familiar to many of us who have worked or do work in continental philosophy. He identified an almost primordial clash of worldviews. While he noted on the one hand that Indigenous identity relies on a unified relationship with the world, he also pointed out its opposite, and so I'll quote him here. He says, taking the world as something that stands over and against me means to understand that world as something fundamentally other than me. And insofar as I am subject, this means that this world is an object. It is the Gegenstand that literally stands against me. Thus I must encounter that which stands against me, the objectivity of things, and bring it under concepts, literally grasp it so as to be able to represent it to myself, so that it becomes thinkable for me. Why must I engage in this process of bringing this world under conceptual determination? Why must I represent things? The reason is that insofar as the world is not like me, or I do not belong to the world, or the materiality of the world of sensuous experience is not like my thoughts, I have to make the world accommodate itself to me. Sometimes language is the agent of both the more holistic Indigenous relationship with the world and the more objectifying one. This is not a presentation about language, but I think most Māori and Indigenous scholars would be aware that through the possibilities our language reveals, a completely different world opens up to the logical academic one. Has the potential to, anyway. There are several possible terms in the Māori language that in fact read like realms. They are not simply dictionary type meanings, but they demand a different kind of recognition. And sometimes we explain them and use them in light of their ancient origins. In some ways, Their forcefulness is embodied through our ceremony. This is what I understand an aspect of the life force of the Māori language to be. It's the kind of manifestation of reality through even just one term. In our current era of colonised thought, one term in Māori has the capacity to challenge the authority of that problematic worldview of Gegenstand, as Arola calls it, if we remain open to the glimpses that the term offers us. I find that language in general triggers my thinking. Its commentary of enlightenment as if language throws light on a situation. To me, though, a Māori worldview that emphasises the togetherness of things has a capacity to throw shade. In doing that, a Māori, and so te reo Māori, or the Māori language, can open up a different kind of thinking for me than, say, conventional English, and I emphasise the conventional there. Academic disposition and writing, on the other hand, are extremely useful for dealing with one idea at a time. They force the Māori scholar on a tight trajectory, one that is often thrilling, a journey, if you will, down a conceptual hydro slide, to use a dreadful metaphor which I promise not to use again. When cracking onto a wonderful thought, a eureka moment, no matter how tiny that thought is, the academic thinker is then the proud owner. You've brought something into clarity, brought about through a good ordering of ideas and things in the world. But there is something about that latter way of referencing the world and its things that does not sit well for several Māori students in particular. I recall one student at undergrad level saying that she felt as if her knowledge was being reduced to a focus on what was visible. With that came a feeling of being trapped between two worlds and an alienation from what she held to be valid. There was, for her, no way of reconciling an approach where the traditional knowledge she learnt placed spiritual thought at the centre, but when she wrote her essay, none of that mattered. Other students have made comments about not being able to use in their work what their elders have told them. If there is any issue of embodiment to those students' last concern, it is that there is a block placed between the student and the earlier generations who hold a certain kind of thinking that does not fit an academic convention, a sort of generational disembodiment. But while that deserves some attention, I'm much more interested in the first student's dilemma, in which her acknowledgement of the spiritual in her thinking is not given any space in conventional academic writing. As Ahinaku et al. State, knowing itself literally comes from the ground, above and beyond, from the wisdoms of continuous metaphysical engagements and familiarity with all our relations. I know for myself, I've felt almost as if there are desperate little sentries operating in academic representation that make sure you do not go into certain spaces. I suspect that this is what that student was feeling, although she might not have described it in that way. Following on from Ahinaku et al.'s quote with the emphasis on the more than human, I feel it is important to emphasise that our identity as Māori and Indigenous students and scholars is indistinguishable from the non-human world. In the Māori world, there is a term that is often translated as genealogy, but also directly references a primordial being that is immediately all other things, including human, but also somewhat contradictorily primordial. The term therefore understands the identity of things as interconnected or even one. Another Māori term exemplifies this relationship between the human and non-human. In Māori, the term wai, W-A-I, means both who and water. With that dual meaning in mind, it would appear that anyone's essential identity is to be read as if it is due to the non-human. The person's who-ness is indebted to that non-human. And in the Māori language, one's well-being is ensured through that unity between the non-human and human. In the Māori language, you ask who someone is in the following way, ko waikwe. You'll see there that there is that term W-A-I there again. The question assumes that there is a deluge of water, but also all other things to which water relates within any one human being. The human being is one confluence of many, of the all, in that regard. While kuwaikwe can mean who are you, this seems to fit too nicely with a very human-centered focus. Another way of framing the interplay between the non-human and human through the term, and I've heard this as a translation, is which waters do you come from? With that, the human being is put in their place, a secondary place to that of the non-human. more down the path of the non-human, we could put kuwaikwe this way. It's close to how I framed it in a talk I gave overseas a few years ago. What is the confluence of the all that such that you manifest as who you are? Terrible English, I know, but my point with this small explanation of the non-human is that Māori students and scholars tread a fine line between moving forward in their ideas as if they are self-generated on the one hand and acknowledging and indeed showing that their ideas are due to the non-human on the other. So can we find ways of re-embodying the non-human into our work? Could that student I talked about before find ways of validly presenting her unity with all things in her work? In my work with the early German Romantics, I noticed that their irrational ways of talking took priority in relation to exactly the same sort of challenge. I was reminded of them when I read that just this year, Professor Jacinta Ruru, Professor of Law at Otago University, has been championing a second law library where other ways of learning Māori law existed, such as art, tukutuku weaving, which is sort of a representational weaving inside the meeting houses, carvings and photos of our maunga or mountains, our awa or rivers, our tipuna or ancestors. Like her, I understand that we need to bring other ways of engaging with our colonised focus to bring about that holistic experience that Arola talks about. I think those treasured items and phenomena she lists are already in use as methods for research, but the list is important as a small set of interventions that could deliberately aim to destabilise colonising authority. That is, traditionally evolved methods, which, by the way, are more often directly employed from the non-human world, are important as counter-colonial measures. Alongside those more traditional approaches, there are simply means of undoing that do just that. They undo, although never completely, that problem of conceptual determination, as Arola puts it. They offer a moment of respite from it. If we wanted to identify a cultural character from Māori existence, it might be the trickster. Here I have Māori philosopher Garrett Cooper's article, Tāwhaki and Māui, Critical Literacy and Indigenous Epistemologies, in mind. Cooper highlights that the trickster in Māori existence was meant to disturb seamlessness and to divert from convention. With that trickster in mind, the student or scholar could offer an academic narrative in the way that is expected, tightly argued, but then revisit it with the aim of giving it an entirely different subterranean meaning. I had one student who did that very successfully in her PhD recently. Her method was to think in a manner that was slightly off from the expected outcome of a thematic analysis. Or a Māori scholar may want to deliberately critique terms as they come up, deliberately lose the expected rational thread, and jump into what that critique reveals and the story that opens up from that. Or perhaps there is a conscious counter-knowledge act at work where what is more important is the journey of the Māori student or scholar. This does open onto the theme of the vulnerable scholar. There is a particular strength to the vulnerable scholar, even though the academy is not big on recognising it. Indigenous Brazilian philosopher and social activist Vanessa Andreotti's book, Hospicing Modernity, with not only its message, but also its novel way of writing so that the Indigenous writer's limits are recognised, is particularly notable here. I'm not talking here about making a habit of being wrong, and neither is Andreotti, but I am saying that part of the issue lies with not setting out with a knowledge-gathering predisposition, which is certainly one that academic convention privileges. The identity and even study of not knowing, deliberately showing in your writing where you reach your limits of knowledge or knowing, could look quite good in a Māori philosophical space. So in conclusion, in this obscenely but soothingly quick talk, I've moved over several things that can be distilled into a few. Do we ignore the confluence that the more than human calls for when we represent things in the world? Should Māori students have to put that to the side? Does that lead to a certain disembodiment of both the human and the non-human, or at least an imbalance? It seems to me that with several discussions taking place in Aotearoa New Zealand around issues of racism and so on, the time is right for a debate around the sort of spiritual disembodiment or imbalance that such Indigenous writers as Andreotti, Cooper and Arola write about. The challenge remains to keep a sustained focus on what crucial wātini, Māori philosopher, calls the conceptual infrastructure in our lives that's hidden from us, And moreover, in the context of our current problem, to perhaps address it accordingly. That is, in a manner that is inconsistent with convention. Thank you very much. That ends my talk.
Thank you so much, Carl. Some fabulous thoughts brewing there. I'm going to ask people to hold on to their thoughts, jot them down, and we'll have a very brief, but necessary, 10-minute discussion time after Liz's keynote. So I'm going to move straight into an introduction of Professor Liz Jackson, and then we'll discuss after that. So Liz is a Professor of International Education at the Education University of Hong Kong. She's the immediate past president of PISA and the former director of the Comparative Education Research Centre at the University of Hong Kong. She's also deputy editor of Educational Philosophy and Theory, and her recent authored books include Contesting Education and Identity in Hong Kong, Beyond Virtue, The Politics of Educating Emotions, and Questioning Allegiance, Resituating Civic Education. Liz's current research is focused on comparative views of emotions and virtues in philosophy and education. So Liz, over to you. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much, Sonia. Thanks, Sonia, and the whole team for organizing this event. And it's so lovely to see all of you here. Really exciting. I know why they turned the chat function off, because if we were at a conference, I'd want to go up and talk to everyone one-on-one. But it's wonderful to see your faces. And thank you so much to Carl for your lovely keynote. Really, really thought-provoking and gives me a lot to reflect upon. So I feel like my topic is a slightly more mundane in some respects, but trying to also work on connecting some philosophical themes to the issue of embodiment and what that means today. So while freedom has been subject to highly abstract philosophical discussion, what freedom has to do with the body and the real world have become pressing concerns during our global pandemic. In relation, vast disparities in COVID cases and death rates in my two homelands, the United States and Hong Kong, reveal significant differences in approaches to freedom from a global view. A neoliberal conception has come to dominate in the United States and among other societies, the United Kingdom. In Hong Kong, this individual notion of freedom is not emphasized. So throughout this presentation, I'm mostly going to be discussing the examples of the United States and Hong Kong in order to explore the concept of freedom. So the body is central here to my messages because I'll be reflecting mostly on the COVID crisis. But I do want to highlight that it's also central because I know about these societies through my lived experiences. When I was thinking about what to discuss today, it's very hard for me to think about anything I felt was more important based on the experience I've been having with the pandemic. Now, I know that I see Gordon here, but most of you are not in Hong Kong or United States. Thank goodness for that. But of course, you will have different perspectives about these societies and, of course, your own society. So the purpose of my presentation is really just to grapple with freedom, the self and other as bodily experiences, and invite your reflection on what freedom means to you. Nowadays in Hong Kong, I don't want to talk about freedom very frequently, but it's hard not to reflect on it as I witness what is happening around the world today. COVID rates are once again climbing in the USA as a result of the Delta variant and the lackluster public response. Under the presidency of Donald Trump, over 630,000 deaths were recorded as a result of the virus. Due to reporting issues, which are both technological and ideological in nature. Probably there was many more deaths than that, which were not attributed to COVID, but for which it was a major factor. In many parts of the country, about 1 in 400 people have died from COVID. People are still dying and rates are going up today in Florida, among other places. If the left-leaning Americans you know do not seem perpetually outraged about this situation, it's probably because we're all grieving it, and grief tends to put people into a fog. So this has been my experience in Hong Kong as well for the last few years. If we've seen many tragic events and changes over the last few years, although we remain quite physically well in relation to the pandemic. For me, I also reflect on the COVID tragedy, which continues in relation to the strange place of freedom in human life. With the end of the American involvement in Afghanistan, I also find myself reflecting all the time once again on 9/11 and the discussion of freedom there. So while about 3,000 people reportedly died during September 11 attacks, Americans were told never to forget that moment. While people deny that it matters that over 200 times that many Americans have died from what they claim is just a bad case of flu. I was struck as a student how quickly 9/11 discourse devolved in the United States and in the UK as a matter of, quote, terrorists who do not like freedom, as President George W. Bush then put it. I did my master's thesis on the topic of freedom in the UK because it seemed to me that Bush did not really understand, firstly, that freedom for US corporations did not provide freedom for Iraqis, and we can say, of course, the same for Afghanistan today. And second, what people think freedom is different across contexts. Many have attributed the individualistic notion of freedom to the philosophy of Immanuel Kant, but I've argued that his epistemology is really more social in nature. He defended free speech specifically as necessary for scholars to work together to build something none of them could build from their own first-person view, inevitably limited by their own experience. On the other hand, John Rawls, with his veil of ignorance, does not put forward the same emphasis on the collectivity. His solution seemed to suggest that some man, like Rawls himself or Kant, can just imagine the place of others and think on their behalf. But we cannot even blame Rawls for what we see in the USA and UK today, which is a blatant disregard of human life. Like Bush after 9/11, today many in the USA are fine with deaths, even their own and that of loved ones, so long as their own sense of their own freedom, in today's case, to walk around breathing in germs without taking life-saving vaccines, is not disturbed. In the UK, I am not convinced that putting on the veil of ignorance could possibly make it reasonable to accept that herd immunity can become possible after many deaths. If people imagine they are wearing the veil of ignorance here, they have got it wrong, as it demands that we think for the least well-off among us. Rawls' veil of ignorance is perverted in these cases, if anything. In the USA, there is the further problem that, like children who would like the freedom to eat delicious ice cream all day long, we cannot be certain these people are in the position to think sensibly about their own freedom and needs, not to mention that of others and their duty to others. Still, there are views of human freedom that allow for a more expanded view of what freedom demands. A capabilities approach is more of value here. As Amartya Sen puts it, there are basic human needs that must be granted for one to exercise their freedom. Chief among these is an education for democratic engagement that empowers one to think empathetically, reflectively, and critically. I wrote about Islamophobia in my first book about education in the USA, but I often wondered if it really even mattered when the whole education system has been under attack for many decades. First, there's been the fight from the religious right against dinosaurs and science. This has been coupled with a libertarianism and neoliberalism, wherein education is treated as a privilege and not as a need or right. Asaya Berlin is the most relevant philosopher of freedom here, with his emphasis on negative freedom, freedom from intrusion from others. The right to be educated well from a negative view of freedom conflicts with rich people's rights not to pay taxes for poor people to be educated. These divergent discourses thus harmonized in US history to result in the neglect of human needs. When people ask me about my concerns about freedom in Hong Kong, I think of this broader context. When I lived in America as a child and young adult, I was terrified of seeing dentists and doctors because it would cost too much money. I already had $200,000 in debt for my so-called public education. It would be $2 million if I had any kind of accident without insurance, which I often did not have. Today, my salary and grants provided by the governments in Hong Kong allow me to continue to self-actualize through producing research I find meaningful, related to social problems. In the USA, this would also be quite different. However, there is more scrutiny of research in Hong Kong and East Asia than in the USA for its social impact, because the government invests in research that benefits society. It's not to benefit me, it's to benefit society. Here also, it's considered my duty to contribute to a public good and not just for my own private good. This notion too is seriously contested in the US. In Hong Kong and other Confucian heritage societies, we wore masks before COVID hit, whenever we had a cold or whenever it was flu season. Somehow, unlike reluctant Americans, we're able to freely talk and walk and breathe while wearing masks. And I'm being sarcastic here. And while some have suggested in quite racist terms that there must be something about the bodily makeup of Asians that helps them avoid the virus, I am certain in this case that the body is not, that the difference is not bodily, but ideological. Although a perverse ideology does certainly affect the body of those who claim they cannot breathe while wearing masks in the Western world. Unlike in Kant, Rawls, or Berlin, the individual does not come first in Confucian, Taoist, or Buddhist views of freedom. While Western philosophers recognize that one's freedom to punch should end before another person's face begins, freedom and other goods are social first in East Asia. The idea that I would have the right to do something that harms others, even indirectly, is not intuitive in this context because I don't come before the group. This was taught to me in January 2020 when my students came to my in-person class on the first day. Maybe that was the last in-person class I've taught. Yeah, I think that was the last in-person class I taught. It was about 18 months ago. While in the West, people imagine that Chinese students are passive and uncritical, my students chastised me for not wearing a mask because that's what you do when you hear it when it's flu season. That's what you do when you hear that there's a bad flu in the Chinese mainland. The downside of this view of freedom is that, of course, I cannot do whatever I would like. The society has lockdowns in certain neighborhoods and is locked down internationally when the community and the world are dangerous to our very life. However, when our community is healthy, we are free to come and go as we please. That we should take precautions, such as wearing masks, is uncontroversial and indisputable here. Theoretically, I have proposed here that freedom is an important concept from a philosophical viewpoint, but even more, that our philosophies of our freedom are inherently tied to our views about our relationships with other people in society. Are we in this together or are we not? In relation, we see the prominence of nationalistic thinking in government responses. Rarely have governments during COVID reacted on a global level, while privatization of some vaccines has at the same time also been encouraged in a more neoliberal viewpoint. So while on the one hand, we have responsibilities to each other in our society if our freedom to simply live is something we take seriously, on the other hand, we have responsibilities to others globally as well. How we treat people fleeing disaster-struck areas today also has important echoes in relation to our view of freedom. Is it a universal human right? Or is freedom only about the self in a conflict and competition with others? The relationship between community and global freedom is another interesting thing to explore because it's not necessarily the case that they are aligned. In Hong Kong, those without visas or rights cannot come into the region now as a COVID precaution, for example, when it was quite easy before COVID for people to come and go out of Hong Kong as they pleased. Finally, you might be wondering what this has to do with education. Well, firstly, these reflections should provide awareness of how our very welfare as a community, local and global, depends on our education. While I'm American by birth, I learned from my students in Hong Kong to wear masks. Many reports in the West have highlighted that people are learning on their deathbeds that COVID is a deadly disease, only learning they want to be vaccinated at a very late stage. More specifically, our understandings of our rights and duties in relation to others is also educated and educable. Politicians and educators send messages about the right values through curriculum, as well as through modeling these values. And I'm sure these modeling of these values is probably more important. In the modern past, when dealing with deadly plagues such as polio, there were very few anti-vaxxers compared to today. While we can reflect on what happened to public education and public civil society in the USA since that time. Finally, we must be more globally minded to learn from other societies willingly. It is possible, it's not rocket science. It's as easy as my students telling me that wearing masks is a moral and ethical responsibility, and me being open-minded to other ways of being and living, to getting used to masks the same way that anyone gets used to wearing high heels or pants or a suit, or learning new manners when traveling outside the home as a child or further abroad. So my time is up now, and I must confess I was only interested in sharing on these topics because I knew of the limited time format. This gives me space to say something interesting, hopefully provocative, without the constraints of being particularly systematic and comprehensive and orderly, because I wasn't sure I could do all of those things in 15 minutes. What I hope I've done is help you, encourage you to think about how your own context shapes your views and assumptions about freedom, bodily and otherwise. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for coming today. And I'll finish there. Thanks, Sonia.
Thank you so much, Liz. And thanks again to both of you. So we'll move directly into the next part of our Zoom Fest, which is a conversation with Carl and Liz. And this is quite brief. So we've got 10 minutes available for us to engage. And I'd ask you now, we've enabled the chat, so please to post your questions, and I'll do my best to move through the questions as I can. And also just to reassure you that you can, of course, engage with Carl and Liz at their universities afterwards. We'll get their contact details and put them up onto the website together with the recordings of their presentations. So I haven't checked that with Carl and Liz, but I'm hoping that that's okay. So that ongoing conversations can happen around these topics. So please feel free to enter some questions.